and welcome to Counsel for the State. I'm Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin. Counsel for the State is a podcast produced by my office. Our goal in each episode is to share information with Idaho residents, journalists, and anyone with an interest in state government. Our aim is to increase transparency, further understanding of the office's role in government, and discuss timely legal topics. I hope you enjoy this installment and consider exploring past episodes as well. With that, here is the Office of the Attorney General, Public Information Officer, and Counsel for the State host, Scott Graff.
Welcome to Episode 12 of Counsel for the State. Idaho State government has made up a number of offices and departments we hear about on a very regular basis. The governor and the secretary of state, for instance, various state lawmakers, the transportation department or fish and game. But it's also comprised of numerous agencies, commissions, bureaus, and boards that don't often make a lot of headlines, but that still play a very important role in our state's day-to-day operations. For instance, did you know that Idaho has a state horse board? On today's episode of Counsel for the State, we'll introduce you to a body that plays a very important function in our state, but that sometimes flies a little bit under the radar, and that is the Idaho Bureau of Occupational Licenses. Joining me for today's podcast is Kelly Packer, Chief of the Bureau. Kelly, welcome to Counsel for the State.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for having me here.
And we're also joined by Brian Kane, Office of the Attorney General, Assistant Chief Deputy, and co-host of the podcast. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks, Scott.
So, Kelly, we appreciate you coming over. Thank you very much for your time today. Your name, for folks who follow Idaho state politics, is one that is recognizable. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? This is a new role. Talk about what you have done historically in state government.
Wonderful. Yes, prior to this position, I actually was in the legislature as a House representative for 6 years. I was able to serve 3 terms there and took a break to actually run for lieutenant governor, but was not successful in that primary, and was then blessed to have Governor Little appoint me to this new position, and I started that role on January 7th when he took office.
How familiar were you with the Bureau prior to the call from the governor?
Actually, probably more so than a lot of the legislators, because one, I owned a styling salon. I'm not a licensed cosmetologist, but I rented space to licensed cosmetologists for a number of years with a salon that I owned and operated. And my husband is a registered contractor, as is my oldest son. They actually own Packer Remodeling. I guess I'm a co-owner and do the books for them, but they've been licensed contractors registered, because in Idaho, contractors are just registered, not licensed, for a number of years as well. So I've had that association, but as a legislator, I also helped on a number of different pieces of legislation. I was the one that sponsored the sign language interpreter legislation that added licensing to sign language interpreters, and worked with many different stakeholders on that, and also became kind of their legislative point person when they had changes to boards because of the knowledge I had in the legislature. So,
okay. And your reaction when the governor called and said, "Is this something you might be interested in doing?" was what?
Actually, thrilled. I was excited. One, that he would give me this opportunity, because I knew it was a high priority for him, but I was also honored by the trust that to me signified that he had in me, that I could do this job, knowing that it was one of his top priorities to have regulation looked at in regards to licensing in the state. He wanted to have unnecessary burdens removed without compromising public safety, and I was excited that I was the person that he felt could do that job.
When you meet people on the street and they say, "Who are you? What do you do?" What's your elevator speech, if you will, on what the Bureau of Occupational License does?
That I'm a partner with the governor, working as his director in the Occupational Licensing Bureau, to help with regulation of 28 boards and 1 commission.
So did you have a moment of panic when the legislature left without approving all the rules?
A moment, Brian? How about
maybe
a few months?
Maybe several moments. Fair enough.
Yes, actually, I couldn't believe it, because what people don't understand when you talk about that is, for most agencies, they had authority over their rules.
Sure.
I had authority over one set of my 30 rules, because I had 29 boards, 28 boards, 1 commission that I didn't have authority over. So I had to have 29 meetings just to get the authority to reauthorize rules, and then on top of that, take on the governor's request or direction, whatever term you'd like to use, to review those rules and find unnecessary language, duplicative language, outdated language, those types of things that could be removed, which then again had to have board approval on our recommendations. So we have had almost three times the number of meetings in this year that they normally would have had under normal circumstances.
So does that have an impact on taxpayers then, with additional meetings or?
A percentage of them, those that are licensed, that's mm-hmm. it, because we deal strictly with dedicated funds, so license fees okay. and registration fees, permit fees, certificate fees. So to a sense, yes, but not as a whole. You know, a small fraction of the residents of Idaho were impacted by that. However, I can proudly say that we've actually implemented some new policies at the Bureau and streamlined and created some efficiencies. So I believe that those costs were actually offset by some of the other things that we implemented. So I don't see any fee increases happening to those licensees because of that additional workload. Luckily, because we could offset it.
Yeah, it sounds like the Bureau and all of your licensing boards really kind of stepped up and I don't want to say they embrace this, but they certainly took advantage of the opportunity that it created.
Absolutely. And it was a wonderful and healthy, I think, practice for the boards. I think that having them be able to look at what's there, most of the legislation and rules, in my opinion, especially going through this practice, the analogy that I like to use is that we have a lot of Winchester houses out there in our mm-hmm. departments and agencies, and not intentionally, I don't think.
Sure.
You had the initial legislation that empowered these different agencies, right? And then they wrote rules. And then over time, as things were presented, as needs arose, those were addressed. And typically, they were just added on to what was there without the look back on should we be removing other pieces while we make these changes. And so I think over time, they just became these unwieldy sets of rules, again, unintentionally, and it's been healthy to be able to go back and say, what is this?
I think that's such an important governmental observation that we have a tendency when we say, oh, we need a new law or rule, that oftentimes we just draft the new mm-hmm. law or rule and we don't necessarily take the time to say, hey, wait a minute, what's already on the books and should it still be there, right? Are we still using it? Mm-hmm. And so I really appreciate you highlighting that. And I think that if anything, you know, for all of the moments of panic or months of panic that you went through, the fact that it gave the state the opportunity to maybe do at least a read through.
Right.
Turned into a tremendous opportunity and, as you identified, a way to more efficiently govern.
Right. And it's actually exciting. Because we had such a vast, I mean, with the governor had already issued his executive orders for the red tape reduction, right, and the Licensing Freedom Act. So we'd already been directed to do full rule reviews of all of our agencies within the Bureau and within the state. And so for us, having all of those sets of rules that we needed to go through, we had decided we would do the bureaus and 14 of the boards this year, and we do the other 15 next year. So that's still, still going to be what happens, because we ended up with having to reauthorize 29 rules, and we did kind of the 30-foot view on all of them, but we still did only the full, real thorough, deep dive on those 14 plus the bureaus sets. So we still actually have a lot of work left to do, but in that practice or in that process, we've identified even some statutory changes that really need to be made.
Sure.
Because what we've done is when we've taken the statutes and put them side by side with the rules, first to look for duplicative language, because a lot of what happened is that they became one-stop shops, the rules did.
Yeah.
And I'd be reading, I'd go, it mirrors exactly what it says in law, and it doesn't add any strength.
And I think I think that's such a great observation, because I think that sometimes when the legislature assigns the responsibility to draft rules, oftentimes folks start from the statute. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, so we need to make rules. Where should we start? And I think it's almost to get the creative juices flowing for rule writing. It's like, well, let's first mirror the statute and then fill in the blanks from there. And as you observed, we don't need that.
No.
Right? Let's just fill in the blanks.
Yeah, the law provides the strength and authority you need. What additional is necessary, if anything? You
right.
may not need anything more, right? But if you do, it should just be the details. And so And that's been hard for some of the boards. I feel my heart goes out to them a little bit because they think, what in the world has happened to our norm?
And I think, and just so you know, I mean, I understand the self-criticism that this involves, because I think it can sometimes be difficult for us as attorneys, right? Because our strongest comfort comes from that kind of shelter of the law. And so we're like, well, the first thing we need to do is get the law on the books
right.
again.
for
and
what?
That may not be the right answer,
right.
because
Absolutely.
We're trying to fill in the blanks and, right. and vagaries.
Can right. you give us an example or two of something that applied in the language to your bureau that was obviously out of date and needed to go?
Well, there were a couple of boards that had language in there from years and years ago that said, you know, that made sense at the time, because it was, as this license starts, anybody that was already practicing prior to this date will need to meet these, you know, type of standards, I guess, these requirements, where after this date, this is what will be required, and that stayed on there for forever. And so I was like, well, since we're 5 or 10 years past even the second date, I think we're good at letting that one go and just having this be our standard moving forward as it's been. So that was one thing. Again, a lot of duplicative language, and we'd go through and say, this is gone because it's already in your statute, which was problematic even for some of the board members. They're just like, what? And we're like, you're fine. You still have authority. We're not stripping anything from you. Some of the things that I found comical were unnecessary definitions, you know, like human. I'm pretty sure we all know what that is.
Really?
But the irony is sometimes, like, for example, and I actually did put next to the margin with this one, seriously, with a question mark, and the boards were like, you don't need to be insulting about it, but it said human, any living person. Well, good. I might not have known that had you not put that in your rule, right?
Right.
So there were other things that were comical, as you've heard, I'm sure, in some of the media coverage of these rules.
I can tell you that as an attorney, you know, a lot of times you come across a definition and you realize something had to have made them think they need a definition of human. And I mean, we'll probably never know, but I would love to have known the scenario that involved this board saying, you know what, we're going to have to define human.
Wow. I remember through the media coverage there being an example of, I think it was the attire that veterinarians were supposed to wear mm-hmm. while working in the fields.
Right, and for the Department of Ag. Yeah. Even, to me, more comical than that one is that the outfitters and guides required their outfitters to be of, you know, clean and clean up, keep something. Oh. And I was like, how many outfitters do you know, if they're really doing their job?
Right.
Are that clean? They're out in the rugged outdoors, you know, climbing, and if their fingernails aren't somewhat dirty, do you really trust them taking you into the backwoods?
You're probably going to get a little nervous.
That's advertising, right? That's good advertising.
That's right.
Right. It's
kind of
like not
establish your credibility.
Yeah, it's kind of like not trusting a skinny chef, right? It's like.
So let's talk about some of the specifics. We talked about your sort of elevator speech about what you do, but for someone that you just meet and they say, what is it that the bureau does? What role does it play in state government? Why is it important for a bureau like yours to exist?
It saves the licensees a lot of money. In fact, I just had this conversation with a board member to help remind them, because they were a little frustrated. I've moved a lot of cheese since I got there, and I'll admit it. But under the direction of our governor, who I applaud for his willingness to spotlight and participate in this important practice that we've gone through, I think it's been a phenomenal growing opportunity for all of us. I'm trying to think of the right words, because it has been hard for those, especially that have been on some of these boards for a long period of time. It's become very territorial for them. It's, you know, pride of ownership, all of those types of things. And here we are on a regular basis, at least, and I don't think they're quite used to this, but I'm pushing back and saying, okay, is that really a necessary function? Is that the decision that you're getting ready to make? Is, yes, up to your complete purview, and you guys will make the ultimate decision, but I want to remind you of what, you know, your role as a board, and making sure that you're being fiscally responsible, that you're not overstepping public safety and going into business practices, some of those types of things. And I don't think they're quite used to that. So here we were moving their cheese when it came to rules and perceived authority and all of those types of things, and it's created a lot of extra work for them. But now in their meetings, I'm being a little bit more vocal too on, should you really spend that money for that? Is that an association function or is that a board function? Those types of things, and they're not used to that. They're used to having more autonomy and no one really looking over their shoulder. But I feel a real responsibility to be able to say, no, we're doing it right here, and that the money that we're spending at the Bureau is necessary expenses, and that's it. And so, but to that point, one of the things that I mentioned a little bit earlier in this podcast is that when I went over there, the boards, all of them were addressing administrative functions as well as their education requirements, scope of practice, discipline, and I made it clear that the Bureau really is responsible for the administrative functions and you're responsible just for your industry rules and laws. So the education and supervision, scope of practice, those types of things are under your purview, but how we handle all of the administrative functions that happen over here, that's really under us. Because to your question, Scott, the Bureau was set up so that all of these standalone boards, or as many of them that want to, can contract with this administrative agency to provide efficiency. So they don't all of them have to have an executive director. They don't all of them have to have individual staff to process applications, or investigative staff to take care of complaints and discipline, or financial staff to handle the payroll and all of those things, front desk staff, insurance, utilities, all of that stuff. They share it, and they have a percentage that they're responsible for paying of the bills rather than 100%. Mm-hmm. Times 29. So it creates efficiencies both in a work process scenario, but also in the financial outlay and cost area. So prior to me coming on, I don't think that was handled exactly the same way as it is now, because now I've said, no, that's going to be under the Bureau function. We'll determine how long an application can go without any activity on it before it expires, and they're going to have to start over. We are going to outline, that what's a completed application and what's not, what the renewal process looks like, when people will be notified for those renewals and reinstatements, and all of inactivity, all those types of things, rather than having 15 to 20 different ways of doing it. Because I truly had specialists that have, three or four boards they're responsible for that were doing three to four different ways for a lot of these things that should have just been the same. And I said, no more. When it comes to administrative, we'll do it, and it'll all look the exact same. And when it comes to your other authorities, it'll be under your purview.
And there's a good reason for that, right? I mean, yeah. You're able to kind of professionalize and make more consistent that administrative side, but in so doing, you actually free your boards up to really dig a little deeper into their charges, right? If they're a licensing mm-hmm. board, are we issuing licenses mm-hmm. That need to go out and have folks met all the requirements? And then if there's a disciplinary mm-hmm. Matter, right? And so they can really dig into those issues without having to worry about that administrative component, which you all are picking up.
Right, absolutely. And it saves them money. If a specialist has to do it different for every little thing, it takes longer to think about, okay, now on this board, I have to do it differently, right? If they just know this is how I'm processing, and I process it all the same for everybody, it really does save money because I don't need as many people because we've streamlined that process too. So there's a lot of benefits to it, but you're right.
Yeah. Well, and if you think about the board, the board members are largely, they're chosen, but they're also kind of volunteers.
All of them.
And so they may be very, very skilled cosmetologists or chiropractors, mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean that administratively they understand that process and everything else. And I think that to me, that shows kind of the value of the Bureau and the ability of you all to kind of work with all these diverse boards.
Right. Well, and I think it also, another key component to that is we've been tasked with the responsibility of trying to be expeditious in the turnaround too. Mm-hmm. And so again, you streamline those processes, we're going to be able to get these applications processed faster, get those licenses issued faster.
Yeah, exactly. As a citizen, if I've just graduated from, cosmetology school, the thing that's standing between me and making money is that license.
Right.
Right. And so I want to get that as quickly as I can. And on the other side, if I've been accused of something where my license is in jeopardy, I want to have an answer.
And as quickly as possible. Without jeopardizing due process, but as quickly as possible under those circumstances, right?
Brian just mentioned a few examples of folks in our state who are required to be licensed. Would you share some more who in our state needs to be visiting with you when they're beginning a profession or moving into the state?
You would be surprised. And in actuality, though, I think one of the misconceptions is that the Bureau only has a fraction of the boards and licenses. We have probably 50% of the boards under us, but we have probably only 10% of the licenses under us. And most people don't realize that, because beyond us, there are also licensing entities in our state within departments. So, for example, the Department of Agriculture has a lot of licenses, like for your commodities. There's a beekeeper license. The Department of Insurance has your insurance companies and agents and brokers. You have the Department of Health and Welfare that has licenses. The Department of Finance has licenses. So there's a lot of departments that do, but you also have standalone boards that aren't under the Bureau that also have licenses, like your Board of Medicine, your Real Estate Commission, your Accounting Board, your Veterinary Board is actually at the Department of Agriculture as far as housed, but is considered a standalone board. So you have a variety of hybrids out there. Under the Bureau, a handful of ours would go for anywhere from, we have like the Athletic Commission and the Athlete Agents, which by the way is one of the registrations that is on the docket to be repealed this year, and I can talk a little bit about that if you're interested. But we have massage therapists, chiropractors, podiatrists, we have the drinking water and wastewater professionals under the Bureau. So if you go to our website, which is ibol.idaho.gov, you will find all of our agencies or all of our boards along the left-hand panel of our website. And you can look up all of the licensees under that website as well. We have almost 73,000 licensees that we take care of in the state for those 29 agencies. And like I said, there's a wide variety. Your lottery commission, well, and interestingly enough, the Idaho State Police have a good chunk of the licensing, because all licensing used to be under them at one time, I guess, back in our history.
So. This gets at sort of the importance of licensing, but why, if I'm an everyday constituent, I'm tuning in to Council for the State here for this episode, and I hear about, you know, all of these requirements for this type of person, and I might be, you know, from the small government realm on the political spectrum, why is it important that people like chiropractors, for instance, need to be licensed in our state?
That's a great question. I think I don't think everything needs to be licensed. I'm one of those that believes in, you know, the lightest touch of government as well. I consider myself to be very conservative when it comes to that. But there are times to protect the public that you need to ensure that that the professional has met the proper education, so that they're going to take care of either patients or clients, you know, customers in the appropriate manner, and not do harm, whether that's fiscal harm, physical harm, mental, emotional harm, because we have counselors and psychologists that are licensed. And then I heard an attorney actually at a consortium that I was at actually put it this way. The reason a license is issued is so that something can be taken away in the event that somebody is a bad actor, really. So it does two things. There's two reasons for a license. One, to make sure that a certain standard is met so that so we can verify for the public that this person has a certain competency to provide the services that that person's going to expend money on, and that potentially put their health on the line for. But then on the back end of that, and if they don't do it in a proper manner and continue to be competent and meet these standards in a safe manner, we have recourse where we can keep this person from doing any future harm by removing that license.
Just to play a little bit of devil's advocate.
Absolutely.
I mean, for a lot of this, can't the market kind of take care of that? Like if I go get a bad haircut, I just don't go to that person anymore.
You know, a bad haircut would be great, but if I go to a chiropractor that cracks my neck and I no longer can walk, that's a little bit higher price to pay.
Excellent point.
And, you know, in fact, the reason that this really was driven home for me with the sign language interpreter licensing that I helped with. When Director Snow came to me initially, and we started down that path, I'll be honest, I kind of raised my one eyebrow at first and went, really? I have a deaf uncle and aunt, love them to pieces, but why? And he explained to me, first and foremost, that thanks to the federal government and some provisions that were changed in the ADA that didn't allow their family members any longer to sign language, to interpret under certain circumstances, courts, doctor's offices, so medical facilities, some of these areas where they felt that it was a little touchier, and I can give you some examples that I was shared to justify their position of not having family members interpret in those on those occasions anymore. The need for qualified interpreters to be available in those settings became critical. Because the people that they normally trusted to provide that correspondence for them or that communication for them was taken away. And I said, okay, but still, couldn't the market just take care of that? And they said, well, let me share you some stories that have happened here in Idaho. We have a double amputee in Caldwell because the leg that was supposed to be amputated was not communicated correctly to the physician and was not marked by the surgical tech appropriately when that person came in. And so they amputated the wrong leg and the infection and the infected leg was still there, and now we have a double amputee. We've had people that have lost lives. I could tell you stories about people that have lost lives because, again, in healthcare settings, the communication wasn't accurate from one to the other.
I remember 3 years or so ago, there was a hurricane, obviously not in Idaho. I think this was Florida.
It was Florida. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Someone stood in front of a press conference, quote-unquote translating, and the person had no idea what they were doing.
And it was not even close.
And that's potentially a situation of life and death.
Right, right.
So recognizing that you definitely have valid needs for licensing, how do you keep the licensing from evolving into a market protection instrument? And this comes out of, for folks that may be listening, North Carolina had a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court over teeth whitening. Mm-hmm. And essentially what the court said was, yes, you can have these licensing boards, but you have to be careful that they have oversight sufficient so that they don't wind up as essentially creating a protected market for the licensees.
Yeah.
And I think that's a challenge anytime you have a licensing regime.
And at every meeting. I can honestly say that's another good reason for the Bureau, to be honest. And boards don't often like it. And in fact, some of my boards don't really care much for me and my legal counsel because we will say, okay, but that's not really your role. Yeah. Your association should be taking that one on if you think it's a problem.
I think that's a really critical component, right, is that every board, every licensing board probably also has a corresponding association. And, are we able to adequately keep those two interests and their legal obligations separate?
Right. And that's, so let me tell you what the Bureau does. I can't speak obviously for
sure.
Some of the standalone boards, but I would assume that similar practices are in place. So there's a couple things. As you know, with that North Carolina case, Idaho then focused, I was in the legislature at the time, on making sure all of the boards had public members on them.
Right.
We do.
For folks listening, what that means is we've got a non-license holding member of the public at large as part of the board, and that's to ensure that it's not just folks that hold a license making decisions mm-hmm. for who gets a license, which becomes that market protection component.
Absolutely. And in little ironic side note to that is I actually have reviewed some of our public people, and there's two of them that I'm asking to have replaced. They don't know that, but because they were retired industry members. And I said, that doesn't meet the spirit
close.
Of the law here, right?
Yep.
Yeah, they're technically a public member now, but they still have a bias, so to speak, in my opinion, to the industry. And we need clear and concise, bright line
separation
from that. So we have reviewed that, and we are making sure that public members really have nothing to do with, right? In addition to that, then the Bureau, or I would think in standalone board cases, your executive director should, again, be somebody outside of that that can kind of remind you that this feels a little bit like we're moving into scope of practice. This feels a little bit more like we are we're treading on, you know, antitrust issues, etc. Really not under your scope. If you think this is important, have your association take it up and talk to the legislature about it, right? So public member, bureau staff in those meetings to help keep discussions on track. And then a really important component is then the process of the legislature. If those things want, if they want to change it, right? If the board or the association wants to change those things, they have to come back to the legislature and make their case. So we have a few things in place, but I think, you know, the legislature has purview over the laws and rules that get brought and making sure that those don't step into that realm. And then we, as the administrative arm again, and the public members of those boards, have to make sure that we are taking our role seriously and pushing back where we feel like we should be. Now, another thing that we do at the Bureau is we have regular training, and even though they've seen the training once, when they come on as a new member, we do it again. Once a year, we try to do the board roles and remind them that when they walk in, they technically are now becoming public members themselves and should be taking that industry hat off and setting it aside and focusing on protection of the public, period, based on your laws and rules.
Yep, at that point, they're trustees.
Right.
Right, and so now they owe duties of loyalty and care, and that training is a critical component of ensuring that those duties are fulfilled.
It really is, and a reminder, because they lose sight. They go back every day. The majority of their time is still spent in their industry.
Right.
And so we need to remind them.
We're sitting here in the Capitol in the Attorney General's office taping. Your office is directly north of us in what's lightly referred to as the Hall of Mirrors. But do you have a presence outside of Boise as well, the Bureau?
No. Well, yes and no. Not really. We are the only administrative home office location in the state, but we do have some investigators and inspectors from their homes that work in some of the geographical areas just to help expedite the complaint and discipline process.
So the complaint process, that's one thing when I looked at the website to research the Bureau a little bit more, because this was also an introduction to some degree for me of your Bureau, sorry, I said board. But I saw the complaint there.
Hope to be division soon. We can talk about that too if you want.
The complaint form. When someone has a complaint, who is it that is filing the complaint, and what does that process look like?
It's a wide variety of people. It can be anywhere from the person that went to a provider or a business owner for a service and didn't feel like they received the service that they paid for, or didn't receive the service they paid for and the money's gone, those types of things. It can be a different industry specialist within the same industry or a different industry that, so for example, with an allied health professional, there might be an MD or a DO that says, I now had to see a patient to take care of problems that arose from services provided from this allied health professional, right? So they can. Really, anyone in the public can. A partner within the same firm could. Anyone has the right to file a complaint. What happens when they file a complaint, though, first, they're going to call in or email in, and our complaint coordinator, the first thing they're going to do is review the laws and rules for that particular license and make sure it's under our jurisdiction, because we don't have the authority over everything that might go wrong,
right.
Only under certain things. And so the first thing we'll do is make sure we have the authority. If we don't, we direct them then at that point to either a prosecuting attorney within their county or the appropriate area.
Perhaps the Consumer Protection Office.
Absolutely, and we have very, very often have done that, because that's the other thing that I think sometimes gets misconstrued is we don't have mechanisms usually in place for restitution. So they're still going to have us both a civil and this public path to follow if they want to try to get back what they lost as well to a certain degree. So typically it's a parallel path for people, because we don't have restitution under our Bureau authority in any case. So then if we do find that the board has authority over it, at that point then an investigation is opened up, and of course then the complainant's spoken to, the respondent's spoken to, witnesses are talked to, everything is reviewed to find out if truly it arose to a level of offense. And if it did, well, regardless, all of that information is gathered and then it's brought, a recommendation is brought in front of the board, who has the ultimate authority to determine. And so the Bureau will either do a, this is what we found, and so we recommend you close it with, you know, no action because we didn't find any problem. The board may agree, may not. We will say, this is what we found, and we advise you to close it with an advisory letter because it didn't rise to too much of a problem, but they could improve their processes in their business. Or we end up in a prosecution type setting where there is going to be a settlement or a stipulation order that's formulated by the board under the board's direction and taken back to the respondent, et cetera, for signature. Or if they disagree with it, then it goes into hearing processes and all of those types of things. So.
We are running out of time. This has gone really, really well. Before we wrap up, is there anything else, Kelly, that you would like to add to today's conversation?
The only thing that I would like to state is that another thing that we are bringing, because we are streamlining the administrative functions, we are going to open up the Bureau statute and completely clean it up and reorganize it and rewrite it. It was formed back in 1974 when the government decided to limit departments to 20 in the mm-hmm. Constitution and then reorganize divisions. And one of the departments became the self-governing agency department, which the governor is at the head of. There's not a director for the self-governing agency besides him. And then under that, you had the Bureau, Division of Building Safety, and then all your standalone boards. Well, the Bureau was formed as a Bureau because at that time there was nobody underneath them, not even an employee or a director, and so it was very small, and it was more a thought and an idea where people could contract and come under. Since that time, as I mentioned, we have now 28 boards, one commission, 146 board members, and almost 73,000 licensees, and we have far outgrown the Bureau distinction, and so we're going to try to change the name during the legislative session with our statute rewrite to the Division of Occupational and Professional Licensing, and then streamline the administrative functions and what those look like, and hopefully make it more attractive for even other standalone boards to come under us and have those same efficiencies provided for them.
Excellent. Brian, anything before we wrap up?
No, I really appreciate the time that you've taken, and I think that the state is lucky to have somebody that has the passion and enthusiasm that you do for this job. I mean, I think it's really important.
Thank you.
The functions that you provide and the enthusiasm with which you bring your administrative capabilities.
I'm loving it. Thank you so much,
excellent.
Brian. Thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate you coming by. This is Kelly Packer, Chief of the Bureau of Occupational Licenses. This is the first time we've kind of gone out of the office and talked about another part of state government besides our office specifically. We will do it again because this has gone so well. I hope they all will go this well.
I hope they do too. Thank you. And thanks for this opportunity, Scott.
We appreciate it very much. Thank you. And also thanks to Brian Kane, the Assistant Chief Deputy here in the Office of the Attorney General.
Thanks, Scott.
And that will wrap up episode 12 of Counsel for the State. If you're interested in learning even a little bit more about the Bureau of Occupational Licenses, you can visit its website at ibol.idaho.gov. If you have not heard any of our other podcasts here on Counsel for the State, you can check those out at the AG's website. That is ag.idaho.gov or through iTunes or Spotify. Our past topics have included issues like internet safety for children, open meetings and public records, and consumer protection issues. Thanks for joining us for this episode. We hope you will join us again for another future episode.